This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Capital punishment is legal in North Carolina, but it's been 5 years since a death penalty sentence has been carried out in this state. Lethal injections came to a halt in 2006 when a dispute over the constitutionality of the execution process led to a de facto moratorium. If capital punishment was a deterrent to violent crime, you would expect the murder rate to have risen in the absence of executions. But that didn't happen, according to Matthew Robinson. He's a professor at Appalachian State University in Boone and the author of a recent report that shows the state's murder rate has, in fact, declined in the past 3 years. And there are other surprises in his study as well. Matthew Robinson teaches government and justice studies at App State, and he joins us by phone from Boone, North Carolina. Welcome to the State of Things, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank.
Before we look at the data, give us an idea what you were intending to do with this research.
Well, there's been a lot of studies done on our death penalty system in North Carolina, both from mostly from scholars in the state, but also from outside. So what I wanted to do is summarize all of those studies, as well as all of the publicly available data on things like murder and executions, for the purposes of creating a policy-relevant document, that is, a document that policymakers could go to if they wanted to learn the facts of the death penalty in North Carolina.
So one of the most important questions in the death penalty is whether or not it is a deterrent to murder. Supporters say that it is, but you found that it may not be. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, deterrence is certainly a logical argument. You know, we assume that dogs and cats and children and everyone, you know, every species learns through punishment. So we swat our dogs who, you know, pee on the carpet, or our cats that claw up the furniture, and we punish our children when they do bad things. But for punishment to be a deterrent, the most important element is certainty. It has to happen. In other words, for a punishment to scare a would-be murderer, there has to be a realistic chance that that person will be executed. But as shown in the report and based on the data, the death penalty is just so rare in North Carolina relative to murder, it's actually illogical even to assume now that it's a deterrent.
So would that mean, and also you found that since the moratorium has been imposed, in fact, the murder rate has declined rather than rise, which is what you would expect if you hadn't had an execution.
That's correct. So basically, you know, when a state stops executing people or when death sentences decline, you would expect murder to go up, you know, based on the deterrence argument. And conversely, if a state started executing more people and sentencing more people to death, if deterrence was a fact, then you would expect murder to go down. But in fact, murder's gone down even as death sentences have declined and even as the state has halted execution. So that really calls into question the argument of deterrence.
Well, if certainty is the most relevant factor, it doesn't, does it? What it really says is if you're going to do it every time.
Right, except that's impossible. So that's kind of the fundamental argument, because you could read the study and say, okay, fine, the death penalty doesn't work because we don't do it enough. And that's actually true. You know, if we did it more than conceivably you would expect a greater deterrent effect. Unfortunately, it's the barriers to imposing it more, the real barriers to imposing it more, makes that impossible.
And what are those barriers?
Well, prosecutors refuse to seek it. You know, when you take on a death penalty case, it often causes chaos and a tremendous drain of resources from other cases. So, you know, death penalty is extremely rare in the prosecutorial decision to prosecute. When they do prosecute, the typical thing that happens is the case ended up, you know, a conviction or even a dismissal for a lesser charge. But when it gets to a jury, juries only impose a death sentence about half the time. And then you have all the barriers to the actual execution, where you have the appeals process and everything like that. We have innocent people being discovered on death row. And that causes us to slow down. And when you're slowing down, due to these barriers, that's when you lose that deterrent effect.
Well, let's just make it easier. I mean, if you're convicted of murder, why should that be any different? Why should it be a capital case? Why should that be harder? Murder's murder. You were found guilty. That's it. Same appeals process. Cheapen the process. Make it less expensive and more certain.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is popular sentiment, and it's a really excellent question. The answer is simply that over time, as the death penalty has been studied and as the death penalty has been litigated, particularly in the U.S. Supreme Court, through the 70s and 80s and throughout the rest of the decades since then, what was created is a process that's called by scholars super due process. And this is to make sure that we don't make mistakes, you know, to make sure that we don't execute someone who's innocent, because that's such a heinous thing to occur. And so we take extra time, we take extra precautions. There's extra resources dedicated to the defense. You know, there's an appeals process that you have to go through to litigate any question of law in the state and federal courts. And so that slows the process down, and it drags it out, and it makes it more rare. So the simple answer is we can't kill them all, and frankly, we really can't kill very more than we already do, given the way the law is written.
And we make an awful lot of mistakes, even among those who we do put on death row. We've talked at length about North Carolina's SBI crime lab, how evidence has been mishandled, leading to unjust convictions, imprisonment, death sentences. What connection did you make between capital punishment and the conviction of innocent people?
Well, we found that, you know, based on the studies and based on the publicly available data, I found that seven people that we know about who are wrongly convicted have been freed from death row. That ranks us seventh in the country in terms of, you know, the most mistakes we make. Of those seven, all of them were accused were convicted of killing white victims, and six of the seven were minorities. Five of them were African American. So, well, what I found was that in the state of North Carolina, mistakes are pretty prevalent, and specifically, they're most common when you have a minority defendant who's convicted of killing a white person.
That's when you find errors in the system. Do race, ethnicity, and gender play a factor in seeking the death penalty or in any other aspect of capital punishment?
Yes, in fact, that's one of the most interesting findings of the report that I did, is that the consistency in the findings among all the studies. So every study that I looked at found evidence of racial disparities in the death penalty system in North Carolina. It's not surprising, because we find this in basically every state that has the death penalty that's been studied. We find the same effect. But what's interesting is that no matter what time period you look at, no matter what study you look at, no matter the data they use, whether they're looking at discrimination against defendants or discrimination against based on victim race, we see clear evidence of disparity, so that a person who kills a white person in North Carolina is about three times more likely to be sentenced to death than a person who kills a minority, who kills an African American. And then we find that to be true even after you control for legally relevant factors that should account for those differences.
So the system shows racial disparities. It is not conclusively a deterrent. In fact, there's indications that it might not be at all. But what about cost? I mean, the fact is that life imprisonment, which would be the alternative to the death penalty, is a very, very expensive proposition for people to accept. Wouldn't it be cheaper just to go ahead with the execution?
And that's the shocking thing probably for most people, is that study after study across the country finds that the death penalty on average is 2 to 5 times more expensive than a life sentence. In North Carolina, it amounts to the same number, somewhere around 3 to 5 times more expensive in North Carolina based on the studies we have here. The studies show that we spend about $20 million alone just on defending capital defendants that we wouldn't spend if we had alternative sanctions. And the reason that it costs more is really easy to understand when you sit down and think about it. Every aspect of the case costs more. The investigation takes up more resources. The trial lasts longer. You have more security. You have more testimony. You have more expert opinion. You have more scientific data. Because, again, we're trying to make sure we get the right people. Then you factor in the appeals process, which is extraordinarily expensive. And by the time it's all said and done, you end up spending more money than if you had just convicted them, sentenced them to prison for life, and paid for them to live for the rest of their lives in prison.
One of the things that we found in the narratives about, we know, released and wrongfully convicted people, in a case like Daryl Hunt, for instance, mm-hmm. is this phenomenon where prosecutors, once they go out on that trail, once they begin to seek the death penalty, it's almost harder and harder for them to admit a mistake, because they've argued that we take a human being's life here. And it's actually more difficult, it seems, anecdotally. And I wonder if any of the data suggests that it's harder for prosecutors to admit mistakes because they've asked for the death penalty.
Well, I haven't seen studies on that particular issue, but we do know, we're pretty familiar from national studies of what the major sources of wrongful conviction are. And so you have, you know, prosecutorial overzealousness. So in other words, a prosecutor really thinks that a person is guilty. It's not like they're trying to frame an innocent person necessarily. They're just trying to do their job and do it really well. And so when they make that determination that they have the right person, they get tunnel vision and they focus on that person and they do their absolute best. I think that's what we expect from a prosecutor, to get a conviction, even when the evidence might not suggest that the person's guilty. So they in some cases, we know they they withhold evidence. That gets in the misconduct issue. When prosecutors start to withhold evidence from the defense, or when they present data like from the crime lab you mentioned, from the blood lab, that's actually flawed. You know, for one case, for example, saying that there's blood on someone's truck when in fact it wasn't blood, and subsequent tests showed that that there was no blood in the person's truck who was convicted of murder, but the jury never heard that. Those kind of cases raise the specter of prosecutorial misconduct. But it's also subtle things like eyewitness misidentification, where a crime victim picks the wrong person out of a lineup or a photo lineup or what have you. You know, incompetent defense is another major cause of wrongful conviction. So those are really the major sources that drive wrongful conviction in the United States.
I've only got about 30 seconds left. Yesterday, though, you presented your findings at a news conference in Raleigh. What else do you plan to do with the data?
Well, the next step after getting it out to the public and the press is to reach out to policymakers. So I'm planning on sending the study this week to the governor, the attorney general, and all members of the legislature who are on key committees that are currently considering death penalty legislation. So the argument is, you know, this is a policy-relevant document. I want to get into the hands of policymakers.
Matthew, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Frank. I appreciate it.
Matthew Robinson's a professor of government and justice studies at Appalachian State. His most recent report is called The Death Penalty in North Carolina, A Summary of the Data and Scientific Studies. You can find it at pscj.appstate.edu/ncdeathpenalty. Just ahead, an art exhibit in Raleigh features the work of 31 contemporary artists and speaks to the African-American experience. You'll hear about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us.